This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, January 17, 2005. From Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., I'm Deepa Fernandes. The Senate Foreign Affairs Committee will hear testimony tomorrow from National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice to become the next Secretary of State. Iraqis react to the sentencing of Charles Grainer for his role in torture at Abu Ghraib prison. FSRN speaks exclusively with the sister of one of the photographed victims of Abu Ghraib. And today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day. We look at how civil rights for people of colour have regressed under the Bush administration. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Calling on the heritage of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., a faith-based group in Connecticut made a plea for peace in Iraq, beginning with a reading of the names of U.S. service members and Iraqi civilians who have died in the most recent military action. Melinda Tuhus files this report from New Haven.
Daniel A. Deesons.
Abdullah Abdul Majid Al Sadun.
Charles A. Kaiser.
Muhammad Asan.
Members of Reclaiming the Prophetic Voice read from Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech of April 4, 1967, in which he called for the U.S. to withdraw from Vietnam. They applied his words to the current conflict.
They must see Americans as strange liberators. We are leaving them little to build on save bitterness. We are adding cynicism to the process of death. For our troops must know after a short period there that none of the things we claim to be fighting for are really involved.
The call to resist noted that increasing numbers of young men are refusing to register with selective service, and more military men and women are risking prison or forced immigration to avoid collaboration with an immoral and illegal war. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven.
We'll have more on the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. coming up. The U.S. military reservist accused of leading the physical and sexual torture at Abu Ghraib prison was sentenced to 10 years in a military stockade. From KPFT in Houston, Renee Feltz reports.
Military jurors at Fort Hood sentenced Army Specialist Charles Grainer to 10 years in prison. He was demoted to private and ordered to forfeit all pay and benefits. When his sentence is completed, he will be dishonorably discharged. No officers have been charged in the scandal, a fact not missed by Grainer's mother, who told journalists following her son's sentencing, "You know, it's the higher-ups that should be on trial." She added, "They let the little guys take the fall for them." Two studies of Abu Ghraib abuses commissioned by the Pentagon found responsibility, though not culpability, lay with higher-level officers. Grainer is expected to appeal. From KPFT, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
Israeli government officials promise an unrestricted attack on Gaza if new Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is unable to control the violence in occupied Palestine. Yet over the weekend, four large-scale Israeli military assaults left 12 Palestinians dead. Mohammed Omar reports from Gaza.
After his inauguration on Saturday, Mahmoud Abbas immediately ordered Palestinian security to prevent Palestinian attacks on Israelis. The Hamas resistance group has rejected the call, pointing at the daily violence of the Israeli occupation as the culprit. This morning in Khan Yunis, a Palestinian mother and son were killed in their home. The father and sister were injured. The Gaza Strip crossings are all closed, and Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's warning that he may invade all of Gaza Strip has left many Palestinians afraid that Sharon's so-called disengagement plan may cost them their lives. For Free Speech Radio News, Mohammed Omar, Gaza Strip.
The former leader of the Communist Party in China, put into hiding after he refused to use military force against protesting students in Tiananmen Square, died today. Severine Bardon reports from Beijing.
His last public appearance had been on Tiananmen Square on May the 19th, 1989. Zhao Ziyang, then General Secretary of the Communist Party and Chinese Prime Minister, had come to beg the students to end their demonstrations. The next day, the Chinese government implemented martial law and eventually sent in the army against the demonstrators. Since then, for 16 years, Zhao Ziyang has been banned from the party and kept under house arrest in Beijing. He died today at the age of 85 years old. The Chinese government fears that the emotion generated by the death of a leader widely seen in China as reformist, human and unfairly sacked would generate social or political unrest. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Severin Bardon in Beijing.
Russia's President Vladimir Putin is granting concessions to protesting retirees who halted traffic in St. Petersburg over the weekend. Beginning January 1st, benefits for seniors, veterans, and other retirees were stopped in favor of small monthly stipends for transportation and subsidized medicine, utilities, and telephone service. Last week, the cabinet said they were to raise the monthly rate by 15%. But President Putin said he may fire his cabinet. Political analysts say there will be a new wave of protests in 2 weeks after January's utility bills are received. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Starting tomorrow, the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee will hear testimony from National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice to become the next Secretary of State. Mitch Jeserich brings us this preview.
Greg Thielman, who once headed the State Department's Intelligence Bureau for Weapons Proliferation, was one of the first internal officials to say that outgoing Secretary of State Colin Powell manipulated intelligence when making the case to the UN that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. And he says he has serious concerns over Condoleezza Rice heading the State Department.
What she had said about the evidence regarding Iraqi nuclear capabilities, one remembers well her talking about warning about the next piece of evidence may be a mushroom cloud. That was a gross distortion of what the evidence was showing us at the time.
So do you think that she had access to the correct information about weapons?
Well, this is one of those subjects in which it's very difficult to know whether she was insufficiently competent or whether she was deliberately deceitful. But she did have access to the evidence of the intelligence community, not only the views of my bureau and the State Department, which ultimately proved to be correct, but the majority opinion at the time, which said that it was likely that Iraq could have its first nuclear weapon in 5 to 7 years, rather than the next piece of evidence might be a mushroom cloud. That is a very big difference.
For some, the nomination of Condoleezza Rice to head the State Department is a sure sign that the neoconservatives within the Bush administration have won the foreign policy debate. Bill Fletcher is with TransAfrica Forum.
The appointment of Dr. Rice represents the complete elimination of any alternative approaches that may have existed within the administration, approaches to foreign policy, that may have existed in the administration while Colin Powell was there. And I'm not upholding Colin Powell as any great example or model, but he did have differences of opinion. The policies represented by Dr. Rice are very much down the line in support of the vision, the world vision and ideology of President Bush. And as such, it represents a very high level of arrogance and an approach towards international issues which is unilateral, and you're either with us or against us.
The Senate is likely to confirm Rice as the new Secretary of State in time to be sworn in the same day as President Bush's inauguration on Thursday. Rice has considerable support from both sides of the aisle. However, she is expected to face many questions about Bush's foreign policy during her confirmation hearing. The administration will heavily rely on Rice to try to change the poor perception the world has of the U.S. Chris Tensing, the editor of the Middle East Report, says the populations of many of the Arab countries would be pleased if the U.S. were more even-handed in dealing with the Palestinian-Israeli conflict.
The single best thing that could be done to improve relations with the populations of the Middle East would be to adopt a more balanced policy with regard to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. If the U.S. were to dramatically reverse course, the course that the Bush administration set in its first term.
Tensing also said the U.S. perception would likely be improved if the U.S. set a firm timeline for withdrawal of Iraq and if it stopped supporting autocratic governments such as Egypt. However, he says he's not confident that having Rice as Secretary of State would alter the administration's policies in the region. Mitch Jeserich, Free Speech Radio News.
Iraqis living outside the country registered today for the elections planned for January 30, while guerrillas in the country attacked this weekend in provinces the U.S. military has deemed safe to hold elections. Violence continued today with a pair of car bombings that killed 8 Iraqi army soldiers and at least 8 civilians. Also over the weekend, Iraqis reacted with contempt but little surprise as Charles Grainer received a 10-year prison sentence for his role in torture at Abu Ghraib prison. Dave Enders has this exclusive report from Baghdad.
When 42-year-old Manadal al-Jumaili was arrested by the U.S. military in November 2003 from his home in Mahmoudiya, about 10 miles south of the capital, his family thought he would be released quickly. By the time photos of abuses at Abu Ghraib prison began appearing on television last April, Jumaili's sister, Montaha, had been searching for her brother for nearly 7 months. That's when she saw pictures of Charles Grainer and other soldiers posing with smiles and thumbs up over a mutilated corpse identified as her brother. He had been dead since November, killed less than a week after his arrest. He is one of more than 30 people who die in U.S. custody in Iraq and Afghanistan. Montaha said she paid some attention to the trial of Grainer, who received a 10-year prison sentence on Saturday.
I don't think of it as one person who killed Monatel. It was a group of people.
Montaha said she was unaware that the CIA agent accused of killing her brother was only facing assault charges.
If he's not a murderer, what is he then? This picture is a crime in itself. I want the person who killed him to be judged fairly, and I want his family to be compensated. They compensated the people in the Lockerbie bombing, but now they have left his family without their father.
Montaha speaks with the frustration of someone who has accepted the hazards of life under the U.S. occupation. One sister is now homeless after the invasion of Fallujah in November, and a cousin was killed by troops at a checkpoint when he failed to stop in time. Jumaili's 3 children, he had a 16-year-old girl and 15 and 14-year-old boys, have still not recovered from the shock.
The 15-year-old has missed a year of school. He cannot concentrate. As for the 14-year-old, his hair is falling out. The mother lost her husband, and now she is losing her sons.
The U.S. military has claimed Jumaili was suspected of participating in the October 2003 car bombing at the Red Cross headquarters in Baghdad.
Do they have any evidence? Even if he did that, there is a courthouse and there are judges to judge him.
Even after the family began going to the prison with photos that had appeared in the news, they were still forced to wait 4 months and hire a lawyer before obtaining Manathal's body. Initially, the death certificate said he had died of a heart attack, though Manathal's eyes had been pulled out and both of his legs had been broken. Jumaili's brother-in-law spent so much time searching for Manathal that he had to quit his job. The family says that there are still unanswered questions. Jumaili's death certificate from the U.S. military says he was killed the day after his capture, but Montaha said others who were in the prison heard his voice and his protestations for some days before he died. In Baghdad, I'm David Enders reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day. We go to an excerpt of a speech he gave in 1967 called Beyond Vietnam.
Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Nor does the human spirit move without great difficulty against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom and in the surrounding world. Moreover, when the issues at hand seem as perplexing as they often do in the case of this dreadful conflict, we are always on the verge of being mesmerized by uncertainty. But we must move on.
Meanwhile, earlier today, in a Senate office building on Capitol Hill, right behind the offices of Free Speech Radio News, we spoke with an organizer of a conference called The Cause, a gathering of over 1,000 young people who came to Capitol Hill to use Martin Luther King's Day to pray for the repeal of Roe v. Wade. Conference organizer Crystal Camacho.
Today, we feel on Martin Luther King's birthday. is we're asking God, we're crying out for the mantle. As Martin Luther King did, as they march for life, we believe we're crying out for life in this time. So it's time for a generation to arise and say, no longer are we silent on this issue. Martin Luther King, one voice, changed a nation. He gripped a nation and changed it. We have over 1,000 people in the Senate building right now just crying out that abortion will end, because January 18th in the Supreme Court, Alan Parker and Norma McCorvey are going in to file their case back to overturn Roe versus Wade.
Let me ask you, was it hard to get access to the Senate building?
You know what? We just totally went out of faith. We went through a senator. We have connections through a senator. We went through that.
Which senator?
I don't think I should say. I won't say. But also,
after inquiring further, conference organizers said they did not want to disclose the name of the senator who helped them get access to the building. A new report released today says that under President Bush, people of color have slid further away from Dr. King's dream. After steady economic gains in the 1990s, Latinos, African Americans, and other people of color have actually lost ground since 2000, according to a United for a Fair Economy report, State of the Dream 2005. We're joined now by the author of the report, Deirdrick Muhammad. Maybe you can begin by outlining for us, Deirdrick, what you found in this year's State of the Dream.
Well, what we looked at this year was this idea of an ownership society, which President Bush talks often about. And the idea of an ownership society where all Americans can own part of the wealth of America is something that Dr. King very much put forward. But what we see through his policies is that Bush's ownership society is much more about allowing the owners of this society to become more wealthy while the rest of us become more and more disowned. And so what we found in this report is that in several different ways, African-American ownership, whether it be home ownership, whether it be business ownership, or whether it be ownership by stocks, and also looking at gifts and inheritance, we see that oftentimes there is a great, actually in all those cases, there's a great racial wealth divide between white Americans, black Americans, and Latino Americans.
What would you say is the most egregious act of the Bush administration in moving away from Dr. King's dream?
I think one important piece is mean gifts and inheritance. We see that white Americans have about 9 times inheritance of African Americans, and white Americans have about 54 times the inheritance of Latino Americans. And we feel that, you know, there's always this complaint about affirmative action giving people an unfair head start. But what we see is that the legacy of racial discrimination is still being inherited by America today through some of these inheritance, which is keeping African Americans, Latino Americans behind.
And Deirdrick, what specifically has the Bush administration done to help white inheritance?
The Bush administration, many conservatives have been arguing to end the estate tax, which taxes the richest 2% of America's inheritance, to try to help more broadly distribute the wealth of this country to really help create an ownership society. And the Bush administration was successful in temporarily ending the estate tax, and now they're going to push to permanently do this. We think a permanent repeal of the estate tax might help create a permanent racial wealth divide in this nation.
Deirdrick Muhammad is the Executive Director of Global Justice and the co-author of United for a Fair Economy's report, State of the Dream 2005. While the nation marks the legacy and sacrifices of civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr., some would say the nation has indeed progressed very little in terms of bringing justice to African American communities for past crimes. 54 years ago, in 1951, a bomb was placed and exploded under the Florida home of African American Harry T. Moore, killing him and his wife, Harriet. The Moores were active in registering African Americans to vote in the Democratic Party. Although it was widely suspected that the Orlando faction of the Ku Klux Klan was responsible for the murders, no one has ever been brought to justice. FSRN's Mark Antokas has more.
There have been many investigations. A 1950s FBI report identified likely suspects, all now dead, a 1978 investigation by the Brevard County Sheriff's Office, and the FDLE review last year, which found no cover-up. Because of pressure brought to bear by the Brevard County NAACP and Evangeline Moore, the daughter of the slain civil rights leader, State Attorney Charlie Crist has opened up a new investigation, hoping to heal old wounds. Ben Green wrote a 1999 biography of Harry T. Moore.
Harry Moore had been doing all kinds of things that would have gotten him killed, and in some ways probably knew that he was committing suicide because of the kind of work he was doing. He was investigating lynchings. He was accusing white sheriffs of being involved in murder and racial atrocities.
I'm angry, I'm disappointed, and I just don't understand how people would be so hateful that they would have allowed something like this to happen and then covered up all these years.
Harry T. Moore registered 100,000 African Americans to vote in 1951, making the state of Florida the largest black voting bloc in the South. His daughter, Evangeline Moore, makes no bones about her reasons for wanting the investigation reopened.
The statute of limitations on civil rights violations, I have been told time after time after time, has expired. We're not talking about a civil rights violation here. We're talking about the murders of Harry and Harriet Moore. And I'm sure they can find out who did it. And I want to know.
Charlie Crist is the state of Florida's attorney general. Crist is expected to make a bid for the governor's office in 2006. He stands to benefit from reopening the case. I asked him whether this was a civil rights issue or a murder investigation.
I think both, Mark, because obviously her father and probably her mother as well were very much involved in the civil rights movement in the state of Florida. In addition, they were killed. So both areas of this office, the criminal division as well as our civil rights division, are investigating this case.
Bill Gary is the current president of the North Brevard NAACP, based in Titusville, Florida. When asked whether this might be just lip service paid by someone with political ambitions, he had this to say.
I do know that the state NAACP is going to bring to bear all and any pressure necessary to see that this case is investigated to the fullest there.
The 1951 murder of civil rights activist Harry T. Moore was the first recorded assassination in the modern civil rights movement, fully 3 years before Brown v. Board of Education and the bus boycott in Montgomery, Alabama. Florida's job now is to put to rest the murder of America's first civil rights leader. History has never recognized Moore the way other civil rights martyrs such as Medgar Evers, MLK Jr., and Malcolm X have been revered. You can visit the Memorial Park and home site of Harry T. Moore in Mims, Florida. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Mark Antokas from WMNF in Tampa.
U.S. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz is visiting the tsunami-devastated country of Sri Lanka as that nation still struggles to get aid to affected peoples. Meanwhile, despite initial objections by the Sri Lankan government, the head of the UN World Food Programme, James Morris, met a Sri Lankan Tamil Tigal leader in the north of Sri Lanka this past weekend. Ponaya Manikavasagam reports from Sri Lanka.
Officials said he visited Indonesia and Sri Lanka to assess the aid effort for victims of Asia's tsunami. Sri Lankan government originally deemed the trip to the rebel-held northern town of Kilinochi difficult. Last week, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan was prevented from visiting the area. Tamil Tigers claim the aid flows into their areas have been restricted, but government officials deny it. While speaking to the press after the meeting with the rebels, James Morris said they are not interested in politics.
Thousands and thousands of people in this part of northeast Sri Lanka who are very hungry, and they've been harmed by the tsunami, and they need food. So we've been setting up a distribution system so that people are fed. We're especially concerned about children. The country has a very high malnutrition rate of children under the age of 5, so we have special efforts to feed children so that they get some high-energy, fortified corn-soya blend food to make up the gap they've had. And we're especially concerned about women and children, women who are pregnant and nursing. So that's what we've been focused on. We are a humanitarian organization. So we're not involved in political issues. We're involved in humanitarian issues.
SP Tamil Chelvan is the Tamil Tigers political leader who meet the international diplomats and heads of UN organizations with a translator of his own to explain the plight of the tsunami-affected Tamils in the northern eastern parts of the island nation.
Pula udanadi pirachane sarvadesa pariya udavigalai eppadi
Our people have suffered for 2 decades during the war. Now their lives are devastated by tsunami. They are in need of urgent humanitarian assistance. A repeated request for assistance to the government has fallen on deaf ears. Therefore, our immediate concern and urgent request is that the international community should provide its assistance directly to the Tamil areas. A certain amount of relief and assistance has been sent to our areas through the government agents, but we have not received any assistance from the government provided by the international community. The government has not made any arrangements to distribute assistance and aids received from the world. We are not aware of any plans of the government in this arrangement.
World leaders and heads of states are now visiting Sri Lanka to assess the aftermath situation of tsunami. But the government and the Tamil rebels are engaged in a tug-of-war in sharing the international assistance pouring into the country. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Ponnaiya Manikavasagam in Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
On New Year's Day, the World Trade Organization banned all international quotas on ready-made garments, clearing the way for low-wage leaders China and India to take the lion's share of the textile market in Europe and America. The decision is having repercussions across the developing world as owners scramble to cut wages and to preserve their profits while staying competitive. From Cairo, Aaron Glantz reports.
For 7 years, 39-year-old Ahmed Ali Ahmad worked in a textile factory in the Egyptian industrial city Mahalla, in the heart of the Nile Delta. There he labored for 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, making high-end cotton bathrobes for the European and American market. The bathrobes retail for about $50 in the U.S., but Ahmed was paid just 75 cents an hour. Still, his salary is triple what textile workers in China or India make, so his boss fired him and offered him his old job back at half his old salary. They can't pay us the same as China or India, he says, because this is Egypt and the cost of living is different here. We work hard and we should be paid. It costs them $3 maximum to produce the bathrobe and they sell it for $50. So they can pay us our salary, he says. Now, Ahmed and 15 other fired workers are fighting back. They've organized themselves and have filed a lawsuit with the help of the nonprofit Center for Trade Union and Worker Rights. But they're not optimistic because a new labor law puts the company in the right.
The owner of the factory can say that because of the economic conditions, he needs to reduce the wages. This is something totally new.
Francois Clement is with a Cairo research institute funded by the French government.
The new labor law, the big change is that any company, public or private, can dismiss a worker without giving justification for it. And this is different from before. Before, the person who had a contract could not be dismissed unless there is legal justification for it.
Another problem the workers have is that, as in most Arab countries, only one government-sponsored trade union is permitted in Egypt. And in this case, as in most cases, the government trade union sided with the company and paid the workers an unemployment benefit of about $15 a month. Rafat Rahman is with the nonprofit Center for Trade Union and Worker Rights, which helped the workers prepare their lawsuit.
It's a comic. It's a comic situation now that this is a federation. It should represent the workers. It cannot represent the workers at all. Even they are always against the workers' movement. And on the other hand, the workers cannot organize their own organization.
With their case still pending in the courts, the workers still have some hope they'll get their old jobs back. They're willing to keep fighting for years because with international textile quotas lifted, they'll never find another job in the garment industry that pays them 75 cents an hour. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Cairo.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.